listeners to Sounding Out's podcast series, an oral chronicle of sound and culture. Sounding Out remixes the everyday with theory, insight, and practice. To learn more, please visit us on the web at www.soundstudiesblog.com. Until then, stay tuned for today's episode.
I want you to imagine a scenario. Imagine that it's nighttime, you had a long day, and you're finally getting into bed. Your family members are in their rooms, the house is quiet, and after tossing and turning for a while, you finally fall asleep. Suddenly, you're being shaken awake by your mom, and she tells you that you have to leave your home right now. Even worse, you may never return to your country again. There's no time for questions. All you know is that you are in danger and you have to leave.
I'm Brad Joseph.
And I'm Amanda Patton.
And this is Refugee Realities, a podcast series where we interview local refugees to explore their individual journeys and the obstacles they've had to overcome. Over the course of 3 episodes, we will be talking to several refugees in the Charlottesville area to learn about how their lives have changed since they were displaced from their homes.
To offer a basic definition, refugees are people who have been forced to leave their country in order to escape war or persecution. Seeking asylum in another country is often a long and difficult process. Many refugees spend months or years in refugee camps, where they may struggle to obtain visas and become stuck in limbo between countries and borders.
In today's episode, we'll be talking to the director of a Charlottesville-based nonprofit that provides support for refugees, to learn more about why refugees are relocated here. We'll also be interviewing a refugee from Western China to get a glimpse into the violence that forces people to seek asylum. But before we get into the podcast, I want to give a quick shout out to the other members of our team at Refugee Realities, including Ahmad Frahmand, our outreach manager, and Melvin Mora, our audio engineer.
This podcast began with one simple question. When refugees are seeking asylum, what brings them to Charlottesville, Virginia? For those of you who aren't familiar, Charlottesville is a large town in central Virginia with a population of approximately 48,000 people. Many people know that Charlottesville is home to the University of Virginia, but fewer people may know that Charlottesville is also home to a significant refugee population.
6% of Charlottesville's population are refugees. That's approximately 3,000 people, which is a fairly substantial amount for a town this size. So to get a better understanding of how Charlottesville's refugee population came to be, we spoke to Kari Miller. Kari is the founder and executive director of International Neighbors, a nonprofit organization in Charlottesville that works with refugees. Kari used to teach English as a second language here in Charlottesville, and working with students who are refugees opened her eyes to how many people need help in our community.
International Neighbors was considered for probably a decade. I was a teacher in the city and for about 10 years thinking somebody should do something. We're getting these refugees placed here through the government, but they were missing so many things. And I realized nobody else was doing anything about it. And so in 2015, incorporated IN to serve our refugee community. We have programs for children, for families, for men, for women, and community.
Kari has worked closely with many of the refugees in the city for the past few years, and she knows a lot about what they have gone through and where they come from. So we wondered why Charlottesville is the home to so many refugees. Are refugees placed in Charlottesville because the resources available in the city, or just because there's space here?
Apparently it is because of 3 factors, one being the public transportation system, that we have one, low unemployment rate, and the UVA Medical Hospital. So those are the 3 reasons.
With an extensive public bus system, ample job opportunity, and a top-tier health system, Charlottesville has been selected as a suitable city for refugee relocation. We asked her to tell us more about the refugee population in Charlottesville.
15 years ago, there were a lot of refugees coming from Somalia, and now most recently, we have Syrians being placed pretty often. I think Charlottesville accepts 240 each year. And so now, quite a few from Afghanistan and Iraq. Many are refugees or SIVs, which are special immigrant visa holders. They come the same path, but the SIVs worked for the U.S. military in Afghanistan or Iraq, and often as interpreters or translators. So they are coming and really are war heroes. You know, they've worked alongside our soldiers, and they can't live back in their country because they're known to have jumped over the fence to our side. But I know of six families who've been here and also returned back to Afghanistan or Iraq because it was too difficult to survive in Charlottesville. We also have quite a few from Burma via Thailand and then Bhutan via Nepal and the Congo, also Burundi. So anywhere that there's really been atrocities and war that these remarkable people have been able to overcome.
It's a common misconception that the entirety of the refugee population originates from the Middle East, when in reality, refugees exist wherever there are atrocities in the world. Some people come from China to escape the religious persecution at the hands of the Chinese government. Some come from Afghanistan to escape an active war zone. Some come from the Democratic Republic of the Congo to escape the ongoing armed conflicts in the country. And many come from several other countries, like Syria, South Sudan, Myanmar, and Somalia.
For today's episode, we spoke to a Uyghur woman from the western part of China, officially known as the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region of Western China. If you were to look at a map of China, the entire northwestern chunk of the country that borders Turkey is the Xinjiang region. The Uyghur people are an ethnic minority in the region who speak Uyghur, a Turkic language, and they primarily practice Islam. Currently, many ethnic minorities in China face persecution due to their minority status and religious affiliation. The woman we spoke to today asked us to omit her name for this interview. So for the remainder of the podcast, we'll be referring to her as Emily.
I'm from western part of China called Xinjiang. I lived here till I was 16 years old.
Emily arrived in the U.S. in 2013 as an international student, and she explained how appalling the conditions in her home of Xinjiang were. She shared one of her first memories of the Chinese government infiltrating her hometown and persecuting her people. Just a warning to listeners, there are mentions of intense violence and mass killings in her interview.
One of the events I remember very clearly, it happened in July of 2009, which is the second latest massacre, which I witnessed by myself. That's the end of the middle school that summer. So me and my brother went outside to meet with my parents. However, that day we came across this killing, the people are running, and the mob actually are, you know, beating those people on the ground. And I was so terrified. We were so terrified that we don't know what to do. So we hide into a shop and wait till my parents come to pick us up, and we went back home.
To reiterate, Emily was only in middle school. At ages 11 to 13, our biggest worries are typically about keeping up with the latest fashion trends, who has a crush on who in our math class, or petty fights with your BFF. But for Emily, her only worry was to stay alive. She realized that she was in the middle of a protest of the Uyghur people against the Chinese government.
So the next day, the Chinese people, actually those Chinese citizens, and together with the military forces, they marched towards our Uyghur concentrated area, and they are pulling out the people from the building, and they are killing them in the yard, you know, in the community. Some people are being killed right away, some are injured very badly, and that event continued for about 2 days, and nobody come out, no military police has come out to beat them back or something, protect us. They just allow them to kill our people.
After witnessing this horrific massacre of her people, Emily hoped that the violence would end. However, she explained that the situation only got worse for Uyghur people. Emily and her family members experienced intense discrimination at work and in school from other non-Uyghur Chinese people.
My parents were receiving those all kinds of discrimination, prejudice, you know, all those negative treatment from the Chinese people. So they have suffered enough, and they don't want the same thing happen to us. So they send the money and all they have to send us abroad. So I'm able to come to America as an international student. But once we came to America, we changed our status. We applied for the asylum approval, and we've been granted in 2014.
When they first arrive in America, refugees do not completely escape the situations they're fleeing from. Some of them still face the repercussions of their escapes in various ways. Emily told us about the persecution her family faced from the Chinese government. Although Emily and her brother managed to escape from China, her parents had to stay behind. The Chinese government constantly questioned her parents about the whereabouts of Emily and her brother. Their goal? To recruit Emily and her brother as spies, so they could gain information on the whereabouts of other Uyghurs living in America. Emily and her parents were not able to stay in touch due to phone tapping and surveillance of the Chinese government, so their only option was to cease all communication.
So I'm really glad that I cut off my relationship, but that's a really painful decision to do because I was not able to talk to my mother for, you know, completely no message from her for a semester or so. And I get to know that actually she got some psychological problem, like she's been depressed. She wanted to kill herself because she's living such a big pressure. Even though she's not in the re-education camp or to say the re-education prison, but she's feeling like living in an open prison already because police is everywhere, and she's been constantly being contacted by the police to give our information.
To clarify, the re-education camps that Emily mentions are internment camps set up by the Chinese government. These camps operate outside of the legal system and are used as a prison for Uyghurs and other Muslim ethnic minorities living in China. They are detained without due process and for indefinite sentence times. Emily emphasized the importance of raising awareness about this massive human rights violation happening in Xinjiang.
There's a lot of people who actually do not know the existence of the refugee or asylee. This re-education camp issue happened in western part of China, my hometown, Uyghur, Xinjiang. To my people, there's about 1 million people being detained in this re-education camp. And even though there's a lot of voices coming out who are supporting us, and we really appreciate that, but I want more people to hear about what's happening to us, what's happening to this 1 million people, Uyghur people living in western part of Xinjiang, western part of China.
So Emily had to start an entirely new life in America. She had no choice but to come to a country where she was unfamiliar with the language and culture to escape persecution. And so many people around the world have similar experiences.
After listening to Emily's story and the larger experiences of the Uyghur people, I felt angry about these injustices. I understand why Kari felt compelled to action after hearing about the stories of refugees in the Charlottesville community. Clearly, this is a huge global issue, but we wanted to get a better idea of what we can do right now in our community to help. So we asked Kari what were some of her goals for international neighbors and the community.
Eventually, I'd love to have a center or an international neighbors neighborhood where people could come. It could be a resource center for our refugee families, also a place where we could hold classes or get more information out to the community, learning about the cultures that exist around us. We always need volunteers. We're always in need of financial support, so anybody can be involved and anybody can do something. And even if it's not something with international neighbors, hopefully when they see someone that doesn't look like them or has a hijab, you know, just to say hello. I've had women cry literally at the grocery store if you just say assalamu alaikum.
For some of us, Charlottesville has been the only home we've ever known. But for others, it might be a new home that they're still settling into. Regardless of how long someone has been a part of our community, they are our neighbors. And we all play an important role in making our city a great place to live in.
Thank you for listening to Refugee Realities, a podcast series revealing the stories of refugees in Charlottesville. In this episode, we looked at some of the struggles refugees go through that force them to leave their homes. Next time, in our second episode, we will be interviewing two refugees from Afghanistan, a mother and her son, to take a look at the generational differences that have affected their experiences in America.
brothers would like talk about how they just walk to school or walk to the market and see like Taliban soldiers with guns on like the back of trucks just like going through town.
I'm Brad Joseph.
And I'm Amanda Patton.
And this is episode 2 of Refugee Realities, a podcast series where we interview local refugees to explore their individual journeys and the obstacles they've had to overcome. Over the course of 3 episodes, we will be talking to several refugees in the Charlottesville area to learn about how their lives have changed since they were displaced from their homes. In today's episode, we will be interviewing 2 different generations of refugees, a mother and her son, emphasizing their respective journeys before and after immigrating to the United States.
I spoke to Ahmad Framand, a member of our production team, to gather his insights and reflections on his own refugee experience.
My name is Ahmad Framand. I'm 22 years old. I was born in Peshawar, Pakistan, but currently I'm a 4th year at the University of Virginia, majoring in English and History.
Ahmad and his family of 8 are refugees from Afghanistan, but Ahmad himself was born in Pakistan. Ahmad and his family came to America 19 years ago to escape the war and violence that plagued Pakistan. Ahmad explained that the war between Afghan and Pakistani government against the Taliban made daily life dangerous.
It was wartime, so there was a lot of violence, a lot of unsureness about, you know, if you'd see the end of the day or make it back home safely. A lot of the war stems from just the Afghan/Pakistani government against the Taliban, who wanted to overthrow them so they can like put up Islamic regime, fundamentalist backwards regime on the country. So a lot of it was just bombings and shootings and stuff in between the two sides, and then the Taliban terrorizing like townspeople in order to like cooperating with them.
Although Ahmad was only 4 years old when he left Pakistan, he shared stories about what daily life was like in Peshawar that he heard from his family members.
My brothers would talk about how they just walk to school or walk to the market and see like Taliban soldiers with guns on like the back of trucks just going through town. And that was basically them trying to like intimidate the people. You should do what we're telling you to do. Like, you know, don't play sports, don't talk to the other side, don't do anything that's like non-Islamic, non-hardline Islamic, or else we'll potentially kidnap you or kill you or something like that.
Ahmad described how his family was constantly under the threat of being injured or killed by the warring groups of Pakistan. But these stories are mostly relayed to him by his family, since he was too young at the time and has a limited memory of life outside of America.
To get a deeper look into what life can be like for refugees before coming to the United States, we spoke to Ahmad's mother over the phone about her experiences in Afghanistan and Pakistan.
My name is Camilla Trauman. I'm originally from Afghanistan. I live in the state here for 19 years, and before coming to America, I was living in Pakistan. Almost 40 years, I was living in Afghanistan. Yes, that's my home country. I love that's, you know, my sweet town, Kabul.
Kamala described her family's life in Kabul, and up until a certain point, their lives were fairly stable and, well, you know, ordinary.
I mean, my husband was working initially in the previous regime before, you know, Mujahideen get to Afghanistan. We had a decent life. Like, my children would go to school. I was a midwife. So, you know, life was okay. Not perfect, not wonderful, but, you know, we were making a living.
And then, danger and uncertainty became much more commonplace in their lives, and Kamala's home country of Afghanistan grew unsafe.
And then when Mujahideen came, my husband did not want to leave the country.
To clarify, the Mujahideen refers to Islamist military groups in Afghanistan that were fighting for power during the time that Kamala was in the country.
Like, one time we were about to die in the apartment building that we were living in. There was a big argument and fighting between two groups of Mujahideen, and then finally my husband decided to leave. So we left overnight.
For many refugees, the dangers in their country may mean living in your home one day and suddenly leaving it the next day. So Kamala and her family headed east and resettled in Peshawar, Pakistan. For the next few years, Kamala would travel back and forth to Afghanistan to visit one of her daughters who was finishing school there. And over the years, Kamala noticed how drastically Afghanistan changed due to the presence of the Taliban.
So speaking of the time of Taliban, the whole environment of Kabul changed from allowing women to go and study, go to school and work, everything shut down, on, especially on women. Men still had the same, you know, freedom as they used to prior to the regime changed. But for women, it was basically not a good environment. I could not practice as a midwife.
Her story portrays the dangers of life in Afghanistan during this time in the late 90s and early 2000s, especially for women.
I was feeling that any minute as a woman, if I step out, they can beat me. They will simply used to beat women just because part of her skin was showing, probably maybe part of her hand. Even the burqa, like if the holes are bigger than normal, they will beat you. They say, well, this is not appropriate. You should wear something that really covers you.
Every day in Afghanistan, the Brahmins would face new challenges. And when they later moved to Pakistan, their daily lives were still fraught with danger. In Pakistan, Kamala's husband, Abib, wrote for a liberal radio station called Freedom Radio. Abib's anti-Taliban journalism made him a target of the Taliban, who were big on censorship. They sent him death threats, they had him followed, and they made it clear that his life and his family's lives were in danger.
And after some time, they start controlling him and trying to follow him a few times, warning him that if he continued to give the correct report, my husband had to listen to them, and they were controlling him, basically. And then he decided to leave because otherwise they were about to come to get him, and I don't know what was their plan. Maybe they were trying to, God forbid, finish, you know, kill him or, like, kidnap him. I don't know what was their plan.
The Brahmin family finally decided that they needed to escape the violence and leave their home country. Kamala knew that America was safe and secure, so they left Pakistan and Afghanistan to come to the United States. They left their family and everything they knew behind to start a new life for their children. And when they arrived in the country, they had to learn how to live in a new environment and a new culture.
First, when I arrived, I heard a lot of great stuff about America, but just for my age, when I arrived, basically I was in my late 40s. It was difficult for me personally because I left all of my families, all of my sisters, my siblings, and my loved ones behind. Uh-huh. And I came to yes, I get it, that the world of opportunity, but no families whatsoever. We did not know anyone in Virginia.
Right.
So, of course, I felt a little bit isolated initially.
Kamala told us that even though her husband had a PhD, he couldn't find work making more than minimum wage. So to support the family, the Brahmin's two oldest children had to get jobs to supplement their income. After months of hard work, they were able to pull themselves out of their Section 8 apartment and move into a house. Kamala recognizes how hard her family had to work to get used to culture in America, but she understands that her younger children, like Ahmad, might have a different mentality regarding the culture shift moving to America.
I came with a different mentality, and that's the truth. But I personally never went out of Kabul and forget about coming to West. And for me, it was complicated, it was interesting, it was fascinating. But for my children, my grandkids, they only know this one culture, which is American culture. And I think the great thing about me is bringing another culture and knowledge and all that, what I learned and what I built prior to coming to the state.
Kamala said that her younger children did not have to experience the same hardships that she did in her home country, since they grew up in America. But she does not want them to forget what life could have been like if they still lived in Pakistan, Afghanistan.
For Ahmad, leaving Pakistan meant that he did not have to grow up in a war zone. But that doesn't mean that life was easy from the moment they arrived in America.
I feel like the threat here at first was the threat of starvation, like the threat of losing your house, losing your means to buy stuff, buy food, etc. It was more poverty. And then just a threat of, like, drive-bys.
The first house that Ahmad and his family lived in Alexandria, Virginia, was not in good condition. I think you just have to hear Ahmad describe it.
After that, we went to Annandale, slightly larger house, less roaches. Our old house was like roaches on top of roaches. When you would turn on the lights, they were stacked. Yeah, so they needed more surface area, so they just climb on top of each other.
Yeah, it wasn't pleasant. While refugees can escape the violence of their home countries, it does not mean that their lives become easy as soon as they arrive in the country. Many people struggle with language barriers, culture shock, and poverty, and rely on organizations like the International Rescue Committee or International Neighbors for food, housing, and language classes. Since Ahmad knows what it is like for people who are forced to leave their home countries and come to America, he has participated in humanitarian work helping refugees. At UVA, Ahmad helped to found the Charlottesville Alliance for Refugees, or CAR, to assist refugees in the Charlottesville area through fundraising, English lessons, and journalism. During our interview, Ahmad described his own experience coming to Charlottesville and the culture shock he experienced.
UVA in general, I feel like I had another culture shock experience where it seemed way too rich and white compared to what I got used to. And it just took a little while to become comfortable here because I was so sheltered where I'm from, where I just didn't see these aspects of American society before I came here.
For many refugees, moving from a foreign country to a city like Charlottesville can be extremely tough and isolating. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, the Charlottesville population is almost 70% white, with a median household income of almost $55,000. That's only slightly below the median income of $57,000 in the United States. For people leaving war-torn or impoverished areas, the culture difference experienced with this move can be astonishing, especially coming to America, where anti-immigration sentiment is so high due to misinformation. We asked Ahmad what he thinks about people in America characterizing refugees as dangerous.
I don't try to directly blame them because most of their beliefs are off of just not knowing. So if you don't know anyone personally, you can't humanize them. You haven't known people like that in your life. You're just going to go off what you hear. But I would definitely try to tell them, like, try to get to know people personally. Try to see the families that are working hard every day, just like any other American family. And just, you know, get to know that we're people just like you. And also that, you know, we're warm, welcoming, good people who just want to make a living, integrate into American society, and just have happy lives.
There is no doubt that the Trump administration is not always welcoming towards immigrants. With policies like Executive Order 13769, sometimes referred to as the Muslim ban, the administration has tried to reduce the amount of refugees that the United States would accept. However, it's important to consider what these refugees have been through before rushing to assume that they are a threat to our country or that they are undeserving of our help. Refugees are simply trying to keep themselves and their families safe and create a better life in America.
Who wants to leave their homeland? I can put myself in the shoes of those individuals. It could be people from Middle East, it could be people from Mexico, you name it.
Yeah.
As long as they are trying to get out of their, that 99% I'm sure they are aiming to come here because this is a world of opportunity.
We're just like you. We have very similar life goals. If we're somewhat different culturally when we first come here, you know, people change over time. But mostly we all are after the same thing, just life, happiness, and success.
Thank you for listening to Refugee Realities, a podcast series revealing the stories of refugees in Charlottesville. Next time, in our third and final episode, we'll be discussing how we can raise awareness about the refugee crisis and how we can work together to help people in need.
I'm Brad Joseph.
And I'm Amanda Patton.
And this is episode 3 of Refugee Realities, a podcast series where we interview local refugees to explore their individual journeys and the obstacles they've had to overcome.
For our third and final episode, we wanted to discuss some of the resources that are available for refugees in Charlottesville. We spoke to the executive director of the Charlottesville International Rescue Committee to learn more about their services. But before we get into that part of the episode, we want to start somewhere totally different, approximately 7,000 miles away. We're going to start on the southeast border of the Democratic Republic of the Congo, where one refugee named Bushiri spent years of his life seeking asylum.
My first name is Bushiri, and my last name is Salumu.
When Bushiri was 7 years old, the Second Congo War began, which has since been classified as one of the deadliest global conflicts since World War II. And although the war officially ended in 2003, the North Kivu region of the Congo, where Bushiri is from, has had continuous armed conflicts. Rebel soldiers regularly raided Bushiri's town of Katwa. And when Bushiri was 17 years old, he suffered the loss of his parents and six of his eight siblings to what he describes as a bombing attack.
It was a bomb. My parents had two houses. One, it was the big houses where my parents and my six siblings slept there. And then me and my two siblings slept in the small house.
Bushiri and his two younger siblings survived the attack because they were staying in a separate house at the time of the bombing. But they were unable to stay in their village due to the danger present, so they were forced to leave.
After that, so some people who knew my parents helped us, and then we ran away. So we worked for a month, like 11 months, so from our town until when we get to the refugee camp.
Bushiri explains that him and his two siblings were with a group of other refugees, all headed south from North Kivu to the Zambia border. They would walk for 3 weeks and then rest, and then walk for a month and then rest. For almost an entire year, they walked from village to village with nothing but the clothes on their back. And at the end of 11 long months, Bushiri said they finally made it to the border and were transported to a refugee camp.
When we get to the refugee camp, it was a big camp. About 22 to 24,000 people. You know, life in a refugee camp was kind of hard. Sometimes we don't have food. We live in the tent. So sometimes it's 120, 150 degrees. So living in a tent, no air condition.
Although Bushiri and his siblings were safe, life in the refugee camps was extremely difficult. Bushiri spent 4.5 years in two different refugee camps, hoping for an organization to pick up his case. After a long period of waiting, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees selected Bushiri's family for interviews. From there, the United States accepted his case and conducted health checkups and interviews with Bushiri for 10 months until he was finally given a visa. In total, Bushiri spent over 5 years in refugee camps. I want you to think about who you were 5 years ago. Where were you in life? How much has changed since then? 5 years is a long, long time. And at the end of those 5 years, Bushiri said he was glad to finally move to America.
I was very happy when they took us from the refugee camp to capital city of Zambia. We came from Zambia to Dubai, Dubai to New York. So the next step, because the big office for IRC International Rescue Community is located in New York City. So they have some paper to fill in the office. After that, the same day, send us here.
They sent you to Charlottesville?
Yes.
5 years and 7,000 miles later, Bushiri and his siblings finally landed in Charlottesville.
We learned in our first episode that refugees are placed in Charlottesville because of the city's public transportation system, low unemployment rate, and the UVA Medical Hospital. Now that we know what brings refugees here, we want to discuss some of the resources that are available for refugees in Charlottesville for our third and final episode. We spoke to Harriet Coor, who is the executive director of the International Rescue Committee branch located here in Charlottesville. We interviewed Harriet in her office at the IRC to ask her about what their organization does around the world.
International Rescue Committee is an international humanitarian organization. We're active in over 40 countries around the world. We have offices in 26 cities around the U.S. So a lot of the work we do overseas is emergency and crisis response, often responding to conflict or post-conflict situations, but sometimes also disasters. And then what we do in the U.S. is pretty much exclusively refugee resettlement and refugee services.
Harriet told us that the office in Charlottesville is fairly small, with only about 20 employees, but she explained the extensive amount of work they put into refugee resettlement around the Charlottesville area.
We know they're coming a couple weeks ahead of time. We look for housing for them. We furnish it. We pick them up at the airport, take them to this house that's furnished, and even to the point of there has to be food in the fridge and a meal waiting for them that they can sit down and eat as soon as they walk in.
It seems like such a simple detail, having food in the fridge and a meal waiting for you. But if this is your first day in an entirely new country with little except the clothes you have, a hot meal can become really important. Harriet explains some of the other immediate work that the IRC does to help new refugees get settled.
And, you know, it's very detailed out. And then we start working, help them apply for Social Security cards, make sure they get a health screening and any medical needs attended to, enrolling the kids in school, and then start working with the adults to help them find employment. Because there's an expectation in refugee resettlement that families should be self-sufficient within 3 to 4 months after arrival.
It takes time for refugees to adjust to life in an entirely new country and city. When Bushiri and his siblings arrived in Charlottesville, he said it was especially difficult at first due to the language barrier. English happens to be Bushiri's third language, after Swahili and French.
First, a few days it was hard because when we came here, we spoke no English. So it was kind of difficult, like communication, but we had volunteers from IRC, so they came to help us, like to go to shopping, to show us around.
In addition to the volunteers who helped Bushiri, the IRC also helped to provide other life necessities.
So they help us to find housing, they give us food stamp, and then they give us Medicare for 8 months. They're looking job for us, then they send us for English classes.
And the IRC continues to support refugees like Bushiri for years after their initial resettlement.
We do that first initial job placement, which is like, you got to get something so you have money coming in. But then we continue working with families on career advancement. We can help people get into workforce training, like PVCC courses, or if they were a professional in their country, like they were an engineer, we can work with them and try and see if we can get them recertified so they can return to their career here.
The work that Harriet describes is only a small sample of the extent of services provided to refugees. The IRC also provides legal support, English classes, family reunification services, youth programs, nutrition programming, parent education, among several other services, with the goal of integrating refugees into the local community.
Since Bushiri has come to America, he has used the employment services of the IRC to try and earn a living. He's worked at a car wash, a restaurant, and a nursing home, and now he is working in housekeeping. But all of these jobs have simply been stepping stones to Bushiri's larger goal. Bushiri wants to go into healthcare as a nursing assistant, and he cites his father as his inspiration because he saw the impact that his father had as a physician in the Congo.
And after living in Charlottesville for the past 6 years, Bushiri has accomplished a lot.
Last year, I get my citizenship, then I get my GD, and then now I'm still taking some prerequisite classes for nursing, and then I'm still taking English classes because I still have difficulty with English, and then I'm taking CNS, CNS Certified Nurse Assistance, because I want to get some experience before I apply for nursing school.
It was a long journey for Bushiri to arrive at this point in his life. Now, Bushiri wants to get his story out to as many people as possible to help others realize how hard it can be for refugees. To wrap up our interview with Bushiri, we asked him if there was anything that people should know about refugees.
That's why I try to write. I put their story in competition every year since 2017. And then I try to share about how refugee life is. So it's now, for me, I can say it's not very easy to be a refugee. The country we came from, we came here, so it's totally different. And then especially for culture, language, so to be a refugee is not easy, it's hard.
Leaving your home country behind is never easy. And often, refugees have little choice in the matter. Through sharing the stories of refugees like Bushiri and learning about all the hurdles they have to overcome, we hope to dispel some of the anti-refugee or anti-immigrant narratives out there.
You know, one of the anti-immigrant narratives that's out there is, oh, immigrants just come here to like get on. Like, people think like because you're accessing public assistance, that just means you're on it forever. And the whole point of public assistance is to be a short-term transition. And that's what we see happening with our families. You know, they need it for a few months and then they're working and they move on. You know, it's not immediate. It takes time.
The United States was largely built by immigrants, and our diversity is what makes this country so great. Harriet told us that the immigrant population in America actually boosts our economy.
The statistic, you know, people don't like statistics. There's pretty good evidence that immigrants grow the economy, and they open small businesses at a much greater rate than, you know, American-born people do and stuff like that. So
In addition to an improved economy, refugees enrich our communities simply by being here and sharing their perspectives. And we could all be a little more understanding and recognize that refugees are not here to terrorize us or take our jobs or take advantage of the system. For the most part, they just want safety and happiness.
What does the term American dream mean to you?
I think it's to live like a better life because there are many opportunities when you came here. You know, if you want to work, maybe 2-3 jobs, so it depends if you want to go to school, so to live a better life.
Thank you for listening to Refugee Realities, a podcast series revealing the stories of refugees in Charlottesville. Over 3 episodes, we have spoken to refugees from Afghanistan, Western China, and the Democratic Republic of the Congo to learn more about the violence they faced that forced them to leave their homes and come to America. We also spoke to the directors of the International Rescue Committee and International Neighbors, which are humanitarian organizations that provide aid to refugees once they arrive in the country. We'd like to sincerely thank everyone who shared their stories with us.
If you feel compelled to do more for your community, the IRC and International Neighbors are always open to new volunteers to help get our refugee neighbors situated. And remember to try to be more accepting and understanding towards people who seem different from you. Because if you talk to them, you'll probably find that they really aren't that different at all.